Hey, welcome to another episode of Bob Saget's Here For You. And it's not just another episode. None of these are. I cherish every one of them. I'm sorry I go on so long. This particular guest will talk more than me. He is a Harvard grad, which he probably won't mention. I'll probably have to mention because he's a humble Harvard grad. He was Steve on Full House and Fuller House, and he was Aladdin, the voice of Aladdin, the non-singing voice of Aladdin. We'll get into that and what it was like to work with Robin Williams. And he is a TV writer and producer and just a wonderful guy and one of my dearest friends. So why not make the Full House cast complete as we keep going through and talking about it now and then for the fans that are out there. He is a wonderful person. And I also want to mention that Ed Asner was on the podcast a couple of weeks back. And then just 2 weeks after it came out, we lost him. And he was a very lovable, wonderful, honest man with controversy always attached, because he was a guy who was an activist and believed in strong things and was also a champion for autism. So you can look up his foundation and give today and be part of that if you're affiliated with anyone or have a family member that is autistic. And he is to be remembered and cherished. And I have some wonderful guests coming up. And so here we go. It's about life, and it's about moving forward, and it's about also remembering good times that you've had with people that you love. So with no further ado, my friend Scott Weiner.
I'm very loud.
I know that since you were a young person.
And I'm loud and I have a distinctive voice that's recognizable. And right. So whenever we're like at the Grove, you know, in the old world, when we used to go places in public and do things. And if my wife pointed out, she's like, if you just talk less loud, nobody notices you. You can just go about your business and nobody's coming up to you for a picture or whatever. She goes, there's a certain decibel level where it's over. You know what I mean? And then one person notices, and then other people notice, and then there's 20 minutes.
And then they think it's Aladdin.
Or whatever, yeah. Or DJ's boyfriend. DJ's husband.
You were DJ's boyfriend?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And then it got married? What?
We got married. Well, I don't want to... No,
I forgot a lot of stuff. I don't know what's going on. The first thing, we've been friends since I met you. We became instant friends.
It's true.
And you came into what season of Full House?
Well, you know, it's funny. I did one episode one year in like, how many seasons were there of the show total?
Eight.
Okay. So then I was a regular in season 6 and 7, but season 5, I came in for one episode. It was like an episode where DJ wanted to go with like the hunky guy from school to the movies, but she was also babysitting the kids. So she takes the kids with her to the movies on the date with the guy.
I didn't approve of that.
No. And then you were very upset. That's just a violation of trust.
Yeah. Danny wouldn't like that.
Yeah. As a dad now, I totally appreciate how you would have felt about that. But at the time I was really on the side of the guy who wanted to make out with DJ, who was me. But the funny thing is, in that episode, I was a guy named Steve Peters, and it was just one episode. And then I flew home to Florida where I lived
to change your name for the next year.
Yeah, literally. And then what happened was then the next year they called and they said, would you be interested in being like a regular on the show and being DJ's new boyfriend? And I was like, sure. And then I came back and instead of being Steve Peters, I was Steve Hale, obviously named after Boyd Hale. Who was
one of the writers. Yeah.
And it's funny because I'm sure there's all kinds of internet chat about why his name changed and everything. But now that, like, as a professional TV writer, I could tell you it's probably they just forgot.
Well, yeah. they didn't forget. What they said was it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
We were not the Tanner family. You don't know that, do you?
No, you were the Goldbaums.
No, we were the Winchester family on a
script.
Wait,
really?
I read a script before I got the job, before upon the first, before the other gentleman had the job, which is bad because I shouldn't talk about it because
I know they you have a lot of guilt about that because you.
Well,
talk
I
about
do because he's a so fine much. Man from everything I've seen, John Posey, and they go and replace a guy, and then there's such a gross world that we're in. That's a good sentence. That they put it in the DVD box set, the original pilot, and you just don't do that. We became a TMZ society around then. And yeah. I think that's when Warner Brothers made TMZ, I guess around then, and that became one of their things. I went, God, are you really making that a big thing?
I don't know. With Warner Brothers, that's interesting.
Yeah, and you don't bite the hand that feeds you, but they're not feeding me right now, so.
listen, if it makes you feel better, I would imagine that that guy got some sort of residuals from the box set of the DVD.
When it sold. Have you ever seen a DVD residual?
I mean, I have, because I sold a lot of DVDs.
Door to door?
Yeah.
Now, let me back up. Let's back way up. So you're behind the wall in that lovely office you're in.
Oh, no, this is a green screen.
Okay, this is a green screen of a house that you wish you had.
No, this is actually, you know, the funny thing is it's obviously a very boring looking like file cabinet thing.
Now, why do you negate things? It's beautiful looking. People in the world would love,
like,
Scott.
No, it looks like Scott Press put it up.
Now, this is where
he bought this house from a guy who was from a family, and the dad was a lawyer, like some fancy lawyer guy, and like this was his lawyery home office.
What's the problem with it? It looks nice. It's perfect for this. It's composed great for a YouTube.
It is. It's good for the thing. And I sort of try to do it so that this little at the top it's just quite boring. We put in this rug during the pandemic for Zooms just to break it up a little and add a little color.
This is going to be the best podcast ever.
I know.
I hate my bookcase because a lawyer put it in.
Well, you know, okay, I can spice up this. I can spice up the bookcase.
Well, your wife's on the other side of the wall, doing a meeting, because your wife is a great writer and she's a showrunner and a television person.
She's a muckety muck, and she's on the other side of that wall breaking an episode of television that's going to be a little bit less good now because of me being so loud.
No, but this podcast will be good for her.
Yeah,
because we'll somehow, do we know the name of her show? Can we plug it?
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it.
Don't talk about it then. Not knowing is best.
Not knowing. It's a mystery.
Wait till the ink is dry. And all I have around behind me is, that looks like somebody said to you in a dentist's office.
Well, you know, your office looks cool, man. When you always, I have to say, you've always had cool homes. You know, I remember, I can think of four of your homes that I remember.
Okay, let's back this up before we go through this, because we're going to try to make this PG, but we're also going to make it real. So this episode in particular, because it's you, will get a lot of Full House and Fuller House lovers. And there are a lot of those people. It'll also be meant for people that want to hear about real relationships that existed because people don't know anything, or they still love each other. That's great. And other people go like, did you hear? And those people should be put in a well. Not physically, just metaphorically.
In a metaphorical well.
Metaphorical well, because they're just fools. But I love them. I love them so much.
Sure.
But the thing is, you were how old when I met you? Were you 15?
No, 16, I bet. I was probably
15. That first episode?
That first episode, I might have been 15.
I think you were.
I had really long hair because I was in a Jim Morrison phase. I was obsessed with Jim Morrison. And so I didn't want to cut my hair. But the problem is, Jim Morrison had that cool, flowy, long hair. My hair just went foom. Like, just came out. You know, nowadays people say, I remember that episode when you had a mullet. But I didn't know what a mullet was at the time.
I don't think it was a mullet. I think it was a bouffant.
Long as a bouffant. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, though, my hair has changed a lot since then. And for the better. And if I had to make a deal with the devil that I could have all that teenage hair back, but I had to have that hairstyle for the rest of my life, I would take the deal.
Why?
Even though it's not perfect, you know?
Why?
It was just flowy. It was just so thick and youthful. You could run your hands through it. You know what I mean?
Do you regret Do you regret that you're not a hairstylist?
I would be a terrible hairstylist. I can't even style my own hair. But
did you ever go to Jim Wayne?
Yeah, I went to your guy. He's your guy.
My guy since I'm 26 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
And is he still your guy? Your hair looks great.
He's not my guy, but I mean, he's everyone's guy.
Yeah,
he's a wonderful guy. He's my guy. He's actually locked up in this room over here.
I gave up on my hair. You know, before Fuller House, when I had to be back on camera and care about what my appearance a little more, I was just going to a barber on the corner. It would take 3 minutes. They'd go snip, snip, and I'd leave. And then when I was on the show, then all of a sudden I had to get nice haircuts. And I started going gray when I was like 21 or something.
Yeah, you did. What was up with that?
Stress, I think. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
I think you're right. I've always talked to you about your self-image, and you were always insecure, and you're always brilliant. And we know each other really well. So, yeah. And we don't see each other enough. And every time we see each other, we always say we have to see each other, but it's really not. But good friends, you can go years, which is really weird.
It is weird. You know what? It's funny. I was talking to my kid about this morning about like time scale stuff. Cause like for him, you know, he started sixth grade today was his first day of school.
Oh, but that's great.
Fifth grade was an eternity ago. Like it's like a lifetime ago. And fourth grade, forget it. He doesn't even remember. You have to show him pictures or whatever. Right. But for me, that was like 15 minutes ago.
I remember fourth and fifth also really clearly.
But I'm saying like his fourth grade, like it was part of, he was in fourth grade during, this is his third school year during the pandemic, you know, but for him, it feels like his whole life.
Has he missed being with other kids and been clear about it? Has he communicated it?
Yeah, but I have to say, I mean, you know, we're really lucky. We're very blessed. We have like a group of friends in the neighborhood, like literally like walking distance that we're super close with the parents. The kids are all best friends. And on that Friday, I think it was a Friday, the 13th of March, 2020, when the world just shut down, D-Day, whatever, we were all together and we were like, guys, let's just we're here already. So let's just stick together for the pandemic. And so we did. We had this little quarantine club, which we unfortunately called the Q Club.
That's not good.
I had like t-shirts made that said like Q forever.
Oh, you didn't know.
I didn't know.
Maybe you were working for the Q-tip company.
I felt bad that the kids, you know, in the summer couldn't go to summer camp. So they hung out together and we called it Q camp for quarantine camp. And I had pennants made up that said Q camp.
Oh my God.
You can't hang it on your wall. You know, the letter Q has been, you know, irredeemable.
Yeah, the letter Q, I think they would have to take it out of all the old Sesame Streets now.
Yeah.
Today's letter is the letter Q. We interrupt this broadcast.
Yeah. Well, we're fortunate. It's not a very useful letter to begin with anyway.
No, not really. Unless you like Quentin Tarantino, and I do.
Yeah. Yeah, he's awesome. He's great. I just listened to him do a podcast recently, and it was really interesting. He's just a fascinating guy.
I love the stuff he's been saying. And I love the interviews that someone will require him to answer and force him to say something. And he goes, I don't want to talk about this.
Yeah.
And that's a rare quality. And some people would think the person's an a-hole. But boy, I'm really cleaning this up.
Well, you know, I don't know much about him, like, as a person. The only thing that I know for sure about him that I find very interesting is he's, like, insanely passionate about movies. Mm-hmm. Like, he thinks they're the greatest, you know, the most important thing in the world.
And I agree with him, except for this podcast and my kids.
Yeah.
But first is Quentin's love of movies.
And then this podcast, and then your
Did you ever see me perform at a place that was always famous, and God, I hope it can open, as the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach?
I don't know if I ever went down there with you. I have been with you on many a night at those comedy clubs, definitely the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory and stuff like that. And then down in Manhattan Beach, I think. What's the one in Manhattan?
That's the Hermosa Beach
one. Oh, that's it. Okay, good. Yeah, so then we did.
So I used to work there in my 20s, and I wasn't on TV or anything, and hadn't been in a movie. And there was a video store across the street. And there was a guy that worked there. And we would just talk about movies the whole time. And it was Quentin.
No way. That was
way. And we would just talk about movies. It was all VHS. And we would just say our love of movies. And every time I've run into him, there's always a sense memory. He doesn't forget anything. He's got a brilliant mind. So
yeah, he clearly remembers everything.
Yeah, and so do you. Well, we both don't remember some things, but that's because
I don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, but I do remember a lot of weird things.
Well, check the toilet later. You'll remember.
That'll be the confirmation. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Alphabet soup. And it says in it, if you're reading this stool, you're too close. So here we go. So you're 15. I meet you. Yeah. And then I met your family yet.
You probably met my mom because she was with me on the set.
Then I did. And your mom, who I love, how is your mom?
She's great. You know, it's funny because, you know, after my parents, a couple of years after that, my parents got divorced and my mom moved to LA full time. And she decided that after a lifetime of being Babs, she wanted to be Barbara. And so she changed her, you know, she's like, Babs is crazy. Let's just be Barbara from that, you know, as part of her new start. But anybody from those days, whenever they bump into me, they're always like, how's Babs? They
right. love Babs.
So funny.
I always called her Barbara. I always felt like we were related. And
yeah,
for many reasons too. This DNA somewhere in Russia, yeah. where sure. great, great grandparents are being killed.
Back in the old country, for
Cossacks
sure.
and our family survived. So
yeah.
So we're here. But the thing is, your mom's birthday and my sister Gay, who passed from scleroderma, her birthday mm-hmm. was January 9th.
Yeah.
And
I always text your nephew Adam on January 9th because I know it's his mom's birthday and he's thinking about her.
So that's a hard day.
Yeah.
But it's a good day. So I I've always loved your mom. She just felt like family. So
yeah, she has that effect on people. She definitely,
so do you, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Well,
you're very warm.
Yeah. Well,
no, I mean, you have a fever. I mean, you better take a COVID test.
I have COVID. No, but
you're so warm.
I'm burning up. I have 106 degree beer. But, you know, you and I, we hit it off right away. We became like instant pals. There was like an instant connection. And, you know, it's funny. Now we're both like grownups. But back then I was
You are.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly. But now I'm older than you. But you were like an instant like big brother, I think, at the time.
I was like a big brother. And then 10 years older than you was another brother of mine, Johnny Silverman.
Yeah.
And then it was me. So there was a 10-year difference from this club of young men.
Yeah, it's true.
And I was the old one.
Yeah, well, but you weren't old. You're still not old.
No, it's really weird.
But no, you were always introducing me to new music. I never, I remember you had a really fancy car, like a crazy fancy Mercedes. It was like handmade and signed by Gunter, you know, whatever the guy who made it. And you would be like, come here, you got to get in my car. So you had your parking space next to stage 24 and you'd be like, you got to hear this. And it would be some new, and you know, now it's all classic stuff because you like have a good ear for things, but it would be like Radiohead. There's this new band, Radiohead. They're amazing. Check them out. I remember Beck. You introduced me to Beck.
Yeah. Well, I'm a loser.
But you also introduced me to a lot of stuff that was like from before my time that I didn't know about that then became my favorite stuff, like Sting's Soul Cages album. I had never heard until you introduced me to it. And there are a few that you tried to get me into that never like The Who, Quadrophenia. I was just organizing my garage and I found it. It was still in the plastic. I'm like, oh yeah, Bob's going to be mad at me.
Bastard.
I know. I just never opened it.
I had never heard Quadrophenia until I was over Dave's apartment. This is, 8 years before Full House. Mm-hmm. And we were in an apartment in Westwood, and Mike Binder lived there.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark Sandrowski.
No way.
Yeah, the director of The Big Bang and many. And a great man.
Yeah.
Lovely,
sweet guy.
And a good friend. He's such a loyal friend. And Dave's a special guy. And I love him a lot. But what happened was we were listening to Quadrophenia. I'd never heard it. And so I was late to the program for them. So it's always, you know, a learning curve. Like you
and I'm so late. It's in my garage in plastic.
I wouldn't use that copy, but I go to Spotify and
Sam Goody on it or whatever.
Says Tower Records on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what do you play for your son?
Well, you know, it's funny. I try very hard to be like the dad that like instills in him proper values in terms of music. Like mm-hmm. I try to play Bob Dylan or whatever. He's like, Dad, I don't like Bob Dylan. I like Juice WRLD. So he loves Juice WRLD. He loves
rap. I don't know what Juice WRLD is.
Well, Juice WRLD is an insanely talented singer, songwriter, rapper, musician, sort of just like a brilliant guy who sadly died from drugs when he was like 21 recently, years ago. Brilliant guy, but my son adores him. And, you know, which is always like a bummer because I don't want, you know, the drug message, you know, but I feel like if anything, his message is a very anti-drug message. It was like a cry for help. You know, he had problems, but he was great. But,
and there's something that you and I shared, which, I mean, we shared when you were, I guess, 17. When was I in Paris and you were in Paris? We're not going through specifics, but
yeah,
when?
Maybe we'll,
no, no,
we'll
but see. I'm just asking, when was
no, but that was the summer probably after my freshman year of college, I think. I had a cool childhood.
So Full House was done?
Full House might have been done. It would have been done. It would have just ended, I think, because right. I left Full House to go to college and
you went to Harvard.
Wow, we've been doing this for minutes and I haven't mentioned it yet.
I know, but there isn't what that. This is what a beautiful man you are. I mentioned it.
You know, my wife says I bring it up and I never bring it up. I like intentionally never bring it up because if you bring it up, you're that guy that like brings it up. You know?
Right.
Yesterday I got an email. This was amazing. It was an email. It was a junk mail, like trying to get me to sign up for a credit card, but it was the Harvard card. So like, it's like the Harvard MasterCard or something. And I was like, that's actually kind of brilliant. You know, like if you're on a date or whatever and you're like, you don't mention it, but then you're like, I got this with my Harvard card. Very, very unsubtle way of mentioning. But
well, then what do you say after that? You want to come home and play Scrabble? I mean, what do you say?
Do you want to go to a
library?
I shouldn't be on this date. I'm married.
That's a good point. I can't wait for you to meet my wife.
Terrible mistake. I get in huge trouble.
My wife's gonna love you.
But so it was a cool opportunity. I couldn't pass it up. I got in and then deferred a year. There was like a postcard that came with the acceptance letter, and you could say, yes, count me in, see you next fall. And there's another one saying, no, I'm going to Yale or whatever. And then there's another one that said, I'm coming, but I'm taking deferring for a year. And so I checked that box and mailed it back, which is funny to think how low tech it was in those days. Right. But, and then I worked for one more year on Full House and then had to leave the show for my, you know, I think if you skip another year, they make you reapply. And I was lucky to get in the first time. So I sat down with probably, I guess it was Mark and Dennis, maybe Tom and Bob, like the producers of the show. And I said, I've got this opportunity and I would be crazy to pass it up. And I remember, I came back. That was my freshman year of college, was your guys' final year of the series. And I came back for the finale. Remember when Michelle gets her memory back and all
now
that?
Now that, we have to talk about that because this will, it's early in the podcast. People are going to want to know this. I checked my clock to see where we're at because I'm real professional.
Broken clock that I bought you.
But the broken clock you bought me is behind my dentist chair. That is the pyramid scheme clock from your Q world. So people were, just to get to that, because people like it, and I don't mind talking about it, because people to this day are upset that the character Michelle fell off a horse and lost her memory.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I got to tell you, you know, I didn't, so they called me and they said, we're doing the series finale. I guess it was probably just the season finale. I don't know if we knew that it was the series finale.
We didn't know. Nobody knew.
But they
called me. Because we didn't know we were canceled.
Oh, okay. So that makes sense. But so it felt, because the atmosphere on stage felt more like a season finale than a series finale. But but basically they called and they said, we want you to be DJ's surprise prom date. So don't tell them that you're coming. Just, we're going to fly you out and hide you in a trailer in the back. And then at the moment, you'll come out in the scene and surprise her and everybody else. So she'll be surprised and the audience will be surprised. And I remember being like excited about it, but so I was bummed because I wanted to be hanging with you guys on the set. It was the last day of the show. And, but anyway, but the point is, I just knew this one scene where I come and I'm like, want to come to the prom, DJ? I had no idea about what was going on in the show. So for decades, people would mention Michelle getting her memory back. I had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah, and it was I don't think it was a good story arc to have a child fall off a horse and not have her and have possible brain injury. And then you as a character on the show and not a producer, you can't really go, guys, this is a weird premise. This is not good for people. And it's too scary. Please, let's not do this. And kids perish on horses.
I just want to say that I think that it raised awareness for childhood amnesia.
I can't remember what you just said, but yes.
But the point is, I didn't know what was going on the show. I didn't know about Michelle getting her memory back. I just knew, ding dong, red light goes on, go in and ask TJ to come with you to the prom. I didn't read the script.
Hey, DJ. and we were all pretty close. I mean, we all had a really good time.
It was like a family. I mean, yeah. It's sort of like a well-known thing. You guys talk about it. I've heard you on your podcast with other cast members from the show talking about how it was a family. And it truly was. I mean, you know, it's funny now, people, you know, like you always talk about, there's like a TMZ culture that we live in now. Or like,
oh man, it's been horrible.
But, you know, and I know they made a TV movie about the show. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't look at that. Whenever I see the photo,
By the way, Steve was always like the ninth banana. I don't know I was in the TV movie, if there was a Steve in the TV movie. But
I hope so.
I hope he had good hair. But
that's all the show was.
But we did have a very, really cool relationship. Like, they're just the group. But by the way, did we talk about, I like this, I brought this for the show. I mean, by brought it, I took it out of a drawer over there.
I love what a pro you are.
This was a gift you gave me during Full House, and it's in mint condition. I could probably sell this for bucks. It's a swatch that you bought me from Fred Siegel, and not just any swatch. It doesn't have a battery. It's like a mechanical movement. Like it oscillates. It's like an automatic movement.
That's a good one. One that you can't see the face.
Yeah. There's no way to tell what time it is. It's a great watch if you don't care what time it is. but it was really, it was funny to find it because, you know, my wife makes fun of me because I got these like plastic bins of like memorabilia from my childhood or whatever, because I had an eventful childhood. Mm-hmm. And, it's fun to like dig stuff up. The other day I was looking through a book and I was looking through this book that I must have been reading on a trip to Paris when I was like 17 or 18 years old. And you sent me a fax to the hotel. It was before email or a text or whatever. And you faxed me like just a note about, you know, and good luck finding the book now, but I put it back in the book and I was like, this was so much fun to find this. And I hope in 10 years I'm finding it again. You know, and I wanted to like just keep finding it. But it was like, it was just a time capsule. You were talking about, it was like happy stuff and fun stuff and sad stuff. I remember it was when your sister was sick and you were talking about how tough that was, but it was like just this moment in time, like a better than any picture. It was this note that was in my book that I must've just used as a bookmark 25 years ago.
We were in Paris at the same time and you loved just reading and you were saying it. What? How do you say it? Ile Saint-Laurent?
I had an apartment on Ile Saint-Louis, which is like this. Oh. Paris is like, if you look at Paris, there's the right bank and the left bank, and then these two little islands in the middle. And the smaller one on the right side on a map is Ile Saint-Louis. And I had an apartment like the size of this Zoom box, but it was so cool. And that was when I was in college. I did a semester in college there.
Right. Yeah. And you would just read Hemingway and go to the Hemingway bar.
Yeah. Which... reading Hemingway is normal for most college kids. Going to the Hemingway bar with their $20 martinis was not normal, but that was like the benefit of being a child actor was I got to go to the Hemingway bar. But
I went there with my wife Kelly on our honeymoon, and we walked in and I said, could I have a table? And they said, no.
Really?
Really? And they were, it was everyone, I just felt like a dirty American. It was so bad. But then I thought, do they not like, is it anti-Semitic or have they seen Full House?
And I love that you went right away to not as the place booked or sold out or whatever. It's like, this is anti-Semitism.
Well, I was feeling my, it was a hotel that the Germans occupied during World War II.
That's true. But to be fair, they occupied the whole place.
Yeah, they did take over the whole thing. They didn't have...
Actually, Bob, the funny thing... Well, no, we shouldn't talk about this.
I've already made mistakes on here that I don't think we'll edit out.
Yeah, but their headquarters, Nazi headquarters during World War II, I don't want to say anything. I don't want to cast aspersions, but it was another hotel that you and I both stayed at. That's an amazing, magnificent hotel that I totally recommend, and it's not their fault that they were occupied by the Nazis. But they probably don't like to be. They probably don't like it mentioned. I probably know too much history. But
you don't want to offend any Nazis?
Yeah, that's what it is. But I, the hotel is a beautiful, magnificent hotel. It's not their fault that they were like violently occupied. But Hemingway, the reason why they named it the Hemingway Bar is because he liberated it. He was the first person to sit down and have a drink there at the end of World War II. After, as soon as the Nazis left, he went in, that's where he stayed. And that little bar in the back where they didn't let you in because of your,
I think it was closing time and it was totally full.
Well, Bob, it's funny because you're so famous and you
not there, not, I think in France, I think it was called Fête de la Maison, which was party in the house. Right. Yeah.
Well, it's true. We were not particularly famous and the show was, I think it was successful in France, but whenever I'm there, which is not that, now the pandemic, I don't go anywhere, but whenever I'm there and someone stops me, it's almost always a tourist or someone from another place.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very rare for French people to stop me, but I,
it's happened more now. When we were there, there was some recognition because with the way television has continued, that show will live everywhere forever somehow now. People in Europe are seeing it now that never saw it when it was on.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's amazing how global it is. Well, I mean, Full House is so, it's so strange for me as a kid to have been on this show when I was a teenager. And now I'm like, it's decades later and I'm a dad and I'm married and I have a very different life now. But it's still like a part of my daily life. And then of course, Fuller House came along and, put it back on the map. And, now it's just never been off the air. I mean, the show's never been off the air since we did it. And now because of streaming, my son went through a huge phase when Fuller House was big, like a couple of years ago when we were like, it was new and he was like exactly the right age for it. And he got super into it, but then he discovered Full House, which was on Hulu. I think it's still on, and he watched every episode.
Yeah, it is.
Which was fun for me because there were a couple hundred episodes I hadn't seen yet. We watched it together.
I can't watch it.
My poor wife would walk in and, we'd be watching me make out with DJ.
Right.
Enough with this thing already. So to get ready to be on your podcast, and it's funny because anyone listening to this would probably imagine that I didn't get ready at all, but to prepare myself, I listened to your podcast with Candace and Andrea and stuff. And Andrea was talking about, you asked her if she took anything from the set, right?
Right.
And I don't think she mentioned. So it was the last day of shooting of Fuller House. We knew the show was over. We knew it was the series finale. Everybody was crying and sad or whatever. And then at the end, there was it was like Black Friday, like people racing to the set to just fill their arms with like souvenirs and stuff, And is it Black Friday or Black Monday when they have all the sales and like Walmart people get trampled?
I think it's Black Friday. Monday is when you return everything.
Or Black Monday is when the stock market crashes. But I'm like, I got to get a souvenir because this was like a very special, five seasons of my life or whatever, 5 years, however long. And so I'm like, I know exactly what I want. I want to go to the set and get that like cookie jar in the shape of the house from the kitchen. So I'm like hustling over there to take it. And I'm like walking towards it. And Andrea Barber, Kimmy Gibbler's boyfriend, is like, gotcha. And he like picked it up and I'm like, oh, and he's like, oh, do you want it?
You mean Adam?
Michael, isn't it Michael? No. Yeah. You mean Adam from the show. I mean, Michael, her boyfriend in real life.
Oh, he took it.
It was, Well, we got it for her. It was like a present. Like, I'm going to go to the set, this special thing for Angry or whatever. And he's like, wait, did you want this? And of course, I'm not going to be like, yeah, dude. No, so I was like,
well, you could have been like that. But
I could have. Maybe I should have.
You're
been.
A sweetheart, Scott. You're just a good person.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. But for a good person, I'm a bastard because I stole this. I went to the alcove. And I took the sailboat from the set.
Joey lived in there.
Huh? Yeah, that's Joey's sailboat. You know, the funny thing is, you know, I felt like...
No, Danny was the nautical one. So Danny loved the sea.
It was your sailboat. So I stole Danny Tanner's sailboat. But look, I don't feel that bad because clearly, you know, people were walking out of there with their arms full. I just took one little sailboat. But it's an iconic sailboat because I don't think if you go back and watch the original show, it's a bigger sailboat. So I think this is just the Fuller House sailboat.
Right.
But I got it. And I feel horrible about it.
No, this is what I love about you. We used to make fun of you I did. You would always go, I feel bad. And then I feel bad because I feel bad.
I always
do impressions of you.
It's true.
Why do you have so much guilt? Why do you think?
Because I'm a thief. I stole not from Danny Tanner. I stole from the set. From Warner Brothers Television.
I stole the barometer in the living room.
You did?
Stamos stole the red doors.
He stole the couch.
He stole the couch. He has the red doors, the entrance.
He stole the doors?
He has the doors.
Okay.
You like the doors?
The couch and the doors, then I guess I shouldn't.
Oh, he's got more than that. I think he has half a set at his house.
I think he has Fun Boy from the Fun Boy episode in his house.
What's Fun Boy?
Don't you remember Fun Boy? There was Mark Warren's son, Danny Warren, who's now an esteemed television writer and a buddy.
Right.
He played a character in one episode. Maybe it was the talent. I don't know. Fans of the show will remember better. But I remember we used to call him Fun Boy because he did an episode where he played a character named Fun Boy.
I must not have been in those scenes.
Oh, maybe. But it was the original show, Full House. The original OG. Maybe it got cut. Maybe I call him Fun Boy for a totally different reason.
No, I think I'm sure it was there. We know Yankee Doodle Boy. He came
back. Yankee Doodle Boy, Blake Ewing, who came back to the show.
And he's wonderful.
By the way, I'm terrible with names, but it was on the tip of my tongue because I just listened to you and Andrea talking about him yesterday.
Yeah.
But he was great. He was fantastic. I have to say, you know, it was really weird. It was like a 5-year high school reunion or something. It was like where
That's what it was.
It was amazing.
And it was wonderful to see the girls running the show.
Yeah.
You know, meaning not running it, but kind of. I mean, they were
being the grown-ups, you know.
Yeah.
Hang on. My son is texting me from school. Hey, Dad,
is that
my
true?
Day's going well so far.
Wait, don't read it yet. It might be something you don't want to share.
Oh, no. I got to go. I'm so happy. Today's his first day of school. He's totally breaking the rules, texting me to tell me he's having a great day.
That's adorable.
Yeah, I love that kid. So, yeah.
Why? Why do you love him? I mean, come on.
You know, it's not unconditional. He has to win my love every day. He has to earn it. No, but it's, you know, being a parent, it's such a weird, the whole pandemic in terms of like being locked at home with your family has been such a mixed blessing because you feel so bad for your kid that he's not having a normal childhood.
Right.
At the same time, it's been so great to be together. You know, it's a blessing. You know, we're very fortunate that we, you know, stayed healthy and all that, been together.
Well, let me go back in time to when you were his age. So you can be found as a child actor everywhere, somewhere.
I grew up in Florida. I didn't grow up in Hollywood, California. I grew up in Hollywood, Florida, which is weird. But I got into acting. I was always like a very hammy kid and I had very poor vision, like blind, couldn't see anything. Not blind, like functionally, you know, I could, you know, once my parents, maybe 5 or 6 years too late, found out that I needed glasses because I was incredibly nearsighted and somehow managed to function in spite of not seeing anything. I wasn't really into sports because somebody would like throw me the ball and I'd go, so I'm supposed to just see it. I would just hold up the baseball glove and not know.
But, so bad.
My dad was like, maybe if you had a two-handed forehand, you'd hit the ball in tennis. And
That's helpful. I thought he was going to suggest a monocle.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I remember when I finally got glasses and I could see the leaves on the trees and the numbers on the clock and the letters on the board. It was pretty upsetting. But I got into acting. I got into like, I was very handy and I liked being in like theater after school and stuff like that. And then one day when I was in third grade, there was a professional actor came and explained, he showed us his little headshot and explained how he, you know, how it worked. And I was in third grade and I came home and I told my parents that I was going to be a movie star. I wanted to be a professional, and it's a job. Up until that point, I didn't realize that all those people on TV and movies and stuff, they were just like, that was just their job. They weren't like, they were human beings. And in some like abstract way, I must've thought they were something else. But I started going on auditions in Florida for like commercials and stuff. And I became like the kid to beat in South Florida for like, you know, the whatever local commercial. I did a Miami Vice episode.
Were you a cocaine dealer in that episode?
I was a juvenile cocaine dealer. I was nine, but I was like,
what did you play on Miami Vice?
I was a precocious coke dealer. No, I was the sick
with a heart of gold.
I was like the Doogie Howser of coke dealers. But was a kid who was sick and I needed a kidney transplant. And my mom was a DEA agent played by Elizabeth Ashley. And right. She was corrupt and she was stealing drug money to pay for my transplant. And which of course, all of that was totally over my head. I just knew I was a sick kid in the hospital in the show. I was too young to know what was going on. But an interesting part that I got when I was maybe 11 or 12 that sort of was transformative for me in like a lot of ways was I got the part of Ernest Hemingway's middle son, Patrick, in this mini series about Hemingway. It was this Stacy Keach played Ernest Hemingway. It was this immensely expensive mini series that they used to do in those days. I guess now it would be a limited series, you know, they're expensive again. But I played Patrick Hemingway at this particular age, 11, 12, which would have been, I guess, in the 1930s. We shot it down in Key West at Ernest Hemingway's house, and which is a museum.
I never knew any of this. And your connection with Hemingway probably started then?
Yeah. What happened was, so, you know, it's a museum, you know, with velvet ropes and stuff and like docents and curators or whatever. But for that moment, this like brief magical moment, they took the ropes down. They dressed the set like it looked in the old days, which, by the way, a lot of the original furniture and things are still there, you know. And I just lived there basically, you know, like during if I would get tired, they'd say, go up to Papa's room and take a nap. And I would go in Hemingway's bed and take a nap. And I would go swimming in the pool. And which is crazy, you know, you can't swim in that pool. It's like, it's a museum. And, but I had this really weird metaphysical thing. And it was in the 1987, maybe. So like, you know, he died in 61. There were plenty of people there who knew him that were still alive that worked for him. And I remember somebody said to me, a lady who worked there said, oh, you sit in this chair at the breakfast table. This was Patrick's chair. You know, it was really weird. And then, his little guest house, which is like the pool house where he used to go upstairs and write every morning, which is still there and perfect. Like, it's amazing to see. But downstairs is a gift shop. And my mom bought me a bunch of Hemingway biographies and novels and stuff. And thus began a pretty weird lifelong fascination with Ernest Hemingway that like is still very intense and unhealthy.
Was there real booze down in the study for Stacy Keach?
I drank very heavily on that set. You know, I wanted to really get it. No, but I...
And Stacy Keach is an amazing actor. What was he like to be with then?
He was great. He was very intense. He was really intense. I remember, you know, this was a long shoot. This was, you know, I was only in one, you know, it was Hemingway's whole life. So he had to play Hemingway as a kid in Illinois and then in World War I and then as an old man in Ketchum, Idaho. And like, you know, he had to do and it was like exhausting, you know, and I just sort of was in the middle of it. And I remember it was a really intense set, but amazing too. Like really, it was like European and like a lot of international, you know, crew. I think our director was German and our DP, I think, was German. It was just like for me to be a kid from like the suburbs of Florida to be in this really exotic and interesting environment, it was like really amazing. And it was just one experience. And then we couldn't go to Cuba back then to shoot at Hemingway's house in Cuba, which would have been amazing to do, but we shot it in Puerto Rico instead at this place that looked like a perfect facsimile. But it, I mean, you know, then I went to college many years later, and not many years later, I guess, in hindsight, but like, you know, I studied Hemingway, went to Paris, and I became an expert on Hemingway's Paris. That's my next job. If I ever like want to, you know, retire and have a job in Paris, I'm going to give Hemingway tours, which my poor wife had to suffer through on our honeymoon.
That's what you did. You took her through all of his steps.
Literally, I'd be like, you see that laundromat? It's actually the original Shakespeare Company. She's like, can we stop?
Right.
By the way, I did that with you too in Paris.
Yeah, you did.
We had a good time. I remember you and I, we had a really cool thing happen to us when we were there. We were wandering around. You and I was going there just by myself in the summertime, because I had my girlfriend at the time was shooting a movie in Prague or something. And I had this like time to kill. So I went to Paris by myself, and I called you from New York before I left. And you're like, what are you up to this summer? I was like, well, I'm going to Paris in a few days. And you were like, well, I'm coming. I think I said, you want to come? And literally that day you booked a ticket and we hung out in Paris. And, but I remember we were walking around one day, and we walked through this door or something. We like took a turn that we didn't mean to take. And all of a sudden we were in an ancient Roman amphitheater. Coliseum.
I haven't thought of that till this moment.
Do you remember that? And there were French kids playing ball in the amphitheater. We just sort of sat there hanging out. Like, it just was a surreal, cool moment. And that place is interesting. And now it's called the Arena of Lutèce, which was the old name of Paris.
I remember jokes that went along with that.
Yeah. But anyway, this is a long digression. You could cut the whole thing out. This would go in the direction.
No, I love this stuff.
But let me just say we've had some good times, you and me.
We really have. And we went to a lot of music together. And you couldn't come to my wedding with Kelly because you were in Paris, I believe.
Yes, I think I was. I think that was when I was.
You were taking your poor Rena through the. And this is where Hemingway peed against the wall. And
Hemingway had a terrible stomachache.
He urinated in this alley. Yeah, it's true. Smell it. Smell it, honey.
I can show you every alley he ever urinated. I was there. I had a really cool experience, like Paris related. I think, and this is why I think I missed your weddings. And I got a job in between Fuller House seasons. Was during Fuller House, right? And yeah. It was in between seasons where I got a job. I was at a meeting at Netflix talking about, I had an idea for a show I wanted to do in Paris, like a rom-com that I had sort of had in my pocket for a long time. And then I heard that Netflix was doing like original language programming in other languages. And I was like, well, what if I pitch it as a French show? And then they can just get some French people to write it with me or whatever.
Just get some French people to write with me. That's going to be the little asset we use to promote this podcast.
Just get some French people. But I went to Netflix, to the international team, to pitch this show. And I was like, so here's the thing. I have this idea. It's a rom-com. I want to shoot it in Paris. And I started explaining my background, my Paris problem. And they were like, wait, hang on. We have a show that's a rom-com that we are having some problems with. You know, would you be interested? And it's one of our first original language French show. Would you be interested in going and just sort of helping out, and, you know, seeing, you know, getting it on track? And I was like the roadrunner on my way to the airport. I got to confirm that my wife will still be here when I return. but otherwise, why would I not want to do that? So smash cut to me being in Paris. We had a writer's room with a view of the Eiffel Tower. I was doing my rewrites at the Café de Magot. Like, it was amazing. It was the coolest. It was a really cool experience. So if that's why I missed your wedding, I'm really, really sorry. But I wouldn't
set the clock back on that. I mean,
when you renew your vows, I'll go to that. But
yeah, we're going to do that publicly for sure. On the beach, you know, and I'll be wearing her dress.
Just mix it up a little.
Yeah. You know? I don't know if I can get Spanx.
I wasn't at your first wedding, but I was at your first.
My first wedding, you were not born.
No, we didn't.
I was 26.
Oh, okay. So no, I would have been born. I was born. I would have been young.
How old are you?
I am exactly 20 years younger than you.
Oh, so you were six. I could have invited you and you could have been a flower boy.
Yeah, I would have been a flower. You know, I'm offended, but we didn't know each other. But I remember, I remember being at your house when your daughter Jenny was born. I remember being your little girls who were amazing artists.
They're even more amazing, all of them.
Yeah. They're incredible. I follow, for people who don't know, Bob's oldest daughters, Aubrey and Lara, are artists, like a brilliant visual artists. And I follow them on Instagram, and I'm always like blown away by all the cool stuff they do. And
Aubrey's paintings are insane how great they are.
Yeah.
And Lara's work is, she welds. It's her
really cool. Yeah. Three dimensional like sculptures. And
she makes a mold and can only make one tree made out of, I don't know what it's made out of, plutonium or something. Platinum, but they're installed.
It's fun to follow it and see what they're doing. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, back when we first became buddies and they were so young, and Aubrey with the oldest was already a brilliant artist. And she had all these paintings that you had all over the house. But because you were rich and famous TV star, you also had like priceless works of art all over the house too. But sometimes it was hard to tell, like, you know, which was the one that you paid $1 million for and which one your daughter did.
My daughter, I paid $1 million for.
Yeah. So,
but well, that's my best investment is my kids.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. And also Bitcoin, but, you know, Doge. Yeah. Why do they call it Dogecoin? Shouldn't it be Douche?
I think it was dog coin because it was dogs. I don't know why it is. I have to tell you that you know that something is going to blow up and become hugely lucrative if I don't invest in it. That's generally the way to know.
Me too.
So if you're like, if you're not sure, if you're like, if it's 2012 and you're like, Scott, are you buying any Tesla stock? And I'm like, what's that? Go buy it.
What does it have anything to do with Hemingway?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not.
Is it French?
I don't make bad investments. I just don't make the good ones that, you know, where you're like.
You know my big stupid one, right?
No.
So Brian Shires, who we like a lot.
Oh yeah. Great guy.
A medical man, a trainer at the time of mine, said, "Hey, I got a friend, and it's his new product, and everybody's given $20,000, and there's only 20 of us." And if you want to give $20,000, you could be in at the bottom level and you'll be, you know, you'll be an owner of this product. Okay. And they sent me a 6-pack of it and I drank it. I went, no, this is making my heart race. People have heart attacks. I can't do that. My dad died of a heart attack. It was Red Bull.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no. So yeah. Is Brian Shires listening to this podcast from his plane?
I'm going to actually send it to him after it's done.
Okay.
But I will. You just did.
Okay. But, hey, Brian.
But I'll say, hey, listen, you're at the almost an hour mark.
But wow, has it been an hour?
We love each other. But yeah. What I was going to tell you was the joke of the whole thing in my rider when I do personal appearances, when I'm on a stand-up tour right now, is Red Bull, Diet Red Bull, probably the worst thing for you. If I am on tour and I am just exhausted, that would be my, you know, bad substance of choice, and I'm doing an ad for it backhandedly right now.
Yeah, it's true. That's my
it's in my rider.
Bad substance of choice.
There would be, I would have been an owner in that.
Oh my God. Well,
I know.
That's a bummer. Yeah, I remember the first time do you remember when I was in college, I had a very cool job where I was like a Good Morning America correspondent.
Tell me about that. I forgot about that.
It was basically, I was a Good Morning America correspondent where they called me and they said, we need someone to interview young people because we feel like the interviews we're getting out of young people, it's always a little bit stilted. It's like, you know, because kids, young people don't know how to relate, you know, it's just a kind of a weird adversarial dynamic, you know, but maybe if we get a young person to do the interviews, it'll be a new thing. And so I was like, hell yeah, that sounds cool. And so I did that for years. But one of the stories we did was we did a story about kids taking like the Eurail trains in Europe and stuff. So we went from like Vienna to Budapest or the other way around. And I remember the crew was drinking that stuff before Red Bull and, you know, like those long skinny cans, and they were like crazy. They were like, their heads were exploding. And I was like, what is this stuff that they're chugging? And then it came to America, I guess, not long after that. But that was my first time encountering it. But was this like Austrian film crew. But
Well, so you did so much child acting. And so in the middle of all this, how does Aladdin come about? Are you tested? Do they have drawings and you voice to them, or were you cast ahead of the game? How did that come about? I mean, we're talking about one of them. They're all famous, all the Disney movies, but one of the most beloved, and you got to work with Robin Williams and Gilbert Gottfried, who is a very soothing voice.
Yeah, and, very calming presence.
Right? So walk me through that, because people love Aladdin, and just tell me how it happened.
You know, it, amazingly, it was just a lucky break. I auditioned for it. You know, I got the part before Full House even. You know, I was on another show before that, another one of Tom Miller and Bob Boyette's.
Which show was that?
This was a show that only ran for a season. It was called The Family Man. And where I was like the wisecracking middle kid on, you know, it was supposed to be one of these like TGIF things that went forever. And then but it was on CBS. And so we did a year on CBS, and then CBS didn't want it anymore. And I think it was going to go over to ABC, which is a weird thing that doesn't happen very often. And we were ready to start. Like, the sets were built, season two was getting ready to go. And then there was some sort of, you know, showbiz shenanigans, and the whole thing fell apart. And I went to camp that summer instead or something. But while I was working on that show, my mom said to me one day, she's like, you have an audition after work for some cartoon. I was like, a cartoon? Because I didn't do voiceover work or anything like that. I was like, a cartoon? Well, I guess that's kind of neat. And went to the audition after work. And my secret weapon is always ignorance, like not knowing that something's a big deal. You know what I mean?
But that's a secret weapon. It actually is. If everybody approached life that way, yeah. And everybody is so, especially in showbiz, but everyone is sweaty for something good to happen. And it's not a negative thing. It's human nature.
Yeah. Whenever the stakes feel high, it's hard. There are very few people who are like at their best in those moments.
Yeah. They choke.
Like the Tiger Woodses of the world, who like when it's really, when everything's on the line, they somehow get better. I'm not like that.
Well, you were with Aladdin.
Well, you know, what happened was, is that I go to the audition for some cartoon, and they're like, so here's a picture of the kid. This is what we think he's going to look like. And they give me the sides, you know, the little script pages that I had.
How old are you at this point?
I was probably 15. And they put it on a little music stand, and I read it, you know, and I could tell they were like intrigued. I could tell I was getting the callback, you know, they liked my voice. And then they said, that was great. They said, oh, the only thing is this is a musical. So do you sing? And I like flat out lied. I lied. Well, you know, listen, I figured, well, you know, this is a disprovable lie. Like I'm obviously going to have to sing for them, and they'll hear the reality of what's
going on. Well, can you sing? Do you think you think you could have been trained to do it? Because some people end up being able to do it.
You know, honestly, in retrospect, in hindsight, I absolutely could have been trained to do it. And I was told this by Alan Menken himself. So this is a really cool thing. You know, I don't plug things. I don't have a lot of things, you know, plugging, you know, right now I'm like working on some writing stuff, but not like nothing like coming on. We're just doing this for fun. Like there's nothing imminent but there is a thing that I would like everybody to go out and watch, which is, so right before the pandemic, we did this, so they re-released Aladdin again, you know, like comes out of the vault. And this was like a big deal because it was coming out of the vault for like the very last time, because pretty soon Disney Plus was about to launch and then it would be available for everybody all the time. And so we made this very special, like special feature for this. It was called the Aladdin Signature Collection. And so we made a documentary basically that I hosted, and it was called Aladdin on Aladdin. And it was basically a half hour documentary about my life as Aladdin and how it happened and how, what it was like going through it and what the, you know, years since have been like, and what my relationship was like with the filmmakers and the other people in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's great. I mean, it came out so great, and I don't think it's available yet on Disney Plus. Like you can't just go to the extras on Aladdin on Disney Plus and see it. It's still only in this like signature collection. I wish some unscrupulous person would put it on YouTube so everybody could see it, but I don't.
But
I don't
this think would. This was a DVD extra.
This was like a Blu-ray thing, like it came out like right before the launch of Disney Plus. I guess they wanted to get one last crack of it, like coming out of the vault or whatever. And it was a special edition, a special, whatever, digital remastered, whatever. But with all
so this is just a couple years ago. So
yeah, we just did this, and it was really fun because I got to interview my mom, who took me to the audition, and I got to interview my wife and my son about what's it like to be this Aladdin thing. Like, how does it affect our life? You know, and it's funny because it really gave us a chance to like reflect on what it means and how it has affected my life. And it totally has in like all kinds of ways. It's really strange. It's like been a part of my life since then. But to get back to the audition, I lied about being able to sing because I learned as a kid actor, that's what you do. Because I auditioned, I think, for Newsies and didn't know enough to lie. And my friend who couldn't sing got the part. He's like, oh, I just told him I could. And then they taught me how to sing.
But that was required in those characters anyway.
Yeah, well, that was a great musical, and they had to dance too. That was on camera, you know, but then Kenny Ortega taught them how to dance. Right. But anyway, but I practiced so hard. I was like, at that point, I kind of wanted to get the job because they gave me a tape of this song that was supposed to be in the movie, and it was just gorgeous. We like played it in the car, and my mom was crying. It was Aladdin singing to his mom about how he was going to make her proud. Like, I know I'm sort of a ne'er-do-well, but someday I'm going to make you proud. And they ended up cutting it from the movie because they cut the mom out of the movie. There was no mom character. Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, the song is back in the Broadway show because he sings it to his dead mom. Like Aladdin is like, mom, I'll make you proud. It's called Proud of Your Boy. But it was this gorgeous song. I practiced and then I tanked that audition so badly. Like I came out of there and my mom looked at me like, eh? And I looked at her like, no. And she's like, I'm really proud of you for trying, you know, because you're not a singer. You don't know how to sing. You know what I mean?
I love your mom.
Yeah, she's great. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, we just felt very zen about it. It wasn't meant to be because I'm not a singer, you know. And then we went home to Florida because the show was finished and never, you know, to return. And then they called me like 6 months later that I was still in the running and they needed to hear me again. And we were like, well, I'm in Florida. They said, well, just mail a tape. So I recorded a tape with my mom playing the genie. We mailed it in and my agent said, we're not sure about Scott's performance. It was a little bit bland, but mom was amazing as the genie. She played it like a Brooklyn genie, you know, like, cause he comes out of the lamp and says, oi, and he's complaining about his neck and stuff.
Yeah.
So, and my mom did that perfectly, like a Brooklyn genie. And, but that tape is now, this is cool. That tape is now in the Disney archives. And they pulled it out. They found it for that movie that we made, the Aladdin.
My
Aladdin.
God.
And so it's really a cool story. You know, I mean, it's cool for me because it's navel gazing, you know, me, like, you know, it's my favorite subject. But at the same time, I think people will find it interesting.
Well, a lot of people are going to ask, and I'm asking, and I'm sure you've been asked a million times. Mm-hmm. Was that part, first of all, was the genie written for Robin or?
Yes. I don't think we would have done the movie without it. You know, they had this idea to make, you know, the fun part about the genie was that he could turn into anything, you know, so it was like the perfect character for Robin. And then what happened was Eric Goldberg, who's the animator for that character, took some stand-up of Robin's and animated it and they played it for him. And they're like, see what we can do with you. You know what I mean? Like,
just take out the F-bombs and we're fine.
Yeah, exactly. But they animated one of his comedy routines and to sell him on it, you know, I think he totally got it at that point. And so he was always in it. And then it wasn't supposed to be Gilbert Gottfried. You know, the idea of the parrot, I think, was originally he was supposed to be this like British upper crust kind of, parrot, like right. A snob. And then they changed it to Gilbert because they realized, well, the genie doesn't come into the movie till like a half hour in and the whole tone will change if it's not that funny. And then he comes. It's like, then it becomes, so we need somebody to keep people laughing for the first half hour so that it's not a total tonal shift when Robin appears. So
what kind of bird is he? Is he a toucan?
I don't know. He's like one of those birds that has a full set of teeth and can talk.
Gilbert has big teeth. I mean,
that's true. I interviewed Gilbert for that documentary, but we couldn't, our schedules didn't work out. When I was in New York interviewing the cast, he was doing stand-up somewhere. And so I had to do it over the phone, but it was really fun.
It would have been Zoom today.
Yeah, exactly. We would have Zoomed the whole thing.
So were you in a room with Robin ever recording or was it all done separately?
Yeah. You know, you're alone a lot for these things. You know, they want to take so much time with every line. So they, you know, there's plenty of time where you're with other actors, you know, bouncing stuff off each other. Mm-hmm. And so with Robin, especially because he improvised a lot. So we had to be, you know, there were certain scenes that we couldn't record separately because he was going to change his dialogue and then it would change our dialogue.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the great moments, you know, of my life was working with Robin. I mean, you know him, you know, you knew him as a friend and you knew him professionally. And you.
I always start to cry, you know, when I hear his name, I just lose it because he really shouldn't be gone, you know?
Yeah. You know, I was with Linda Larkin, who's the voice of Princess Jasmine, and we were at, we did an amazing thing when I was in New York to interview her for this documentary. We did a screening for kids, you know, like of kids who had never seen Aladdin, which I always get a kick out of because it's like this old classic movie now, but there's a whole new generation every couple of years who's never seen it. And Linda and I were on stage doing the Q&A with the kids afterwards. And one of the kids' questions was, who's the voice of the genie? And that I had to hand the microphone over to Linda because it just, you know, these kids just are, don't live in a, will never live in a world with Robin Williams in it. And I felt so bad for them, you know, but they, you know, he was just a special, you know, person on the earth and so funny. And for me personally, you know, I was a kid. I was just like in awe. I was freaking out. I was totally starstruck trying to keep it together. But he, you know, my favorite movie then, and another movie that was sort of life-changing for me because it made me want to go to like be an English major at some college.
Let me guess.
Like Dead Poets Society. I had like a full wall-size poster of it on my wall. You know, I couldn't believe I was in the room with this guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
the thing about Robin is if he had never done stand-up, and that was always where he came out of, improv and stand-up, but it also trained Juilliard actor. Mm-hmm. He was so unusually explosively talented that his movie acting alone would have made him the biggest star in the world. I mean, it's Mrs. Doubtfire,
My kid loves. Watch.
Well, it's a gift. That movie's a gift. And
but his comedy was amazing. But also like Good Will Hunting and his Dead Poets and all of his drama stuff was amazing. He was just
he was
awakening.
Quite beautiful. And
lucky to have a friendship with him.
I mean, well, it wasn't, I would say a close acquaintance. You know, people always go, your friend, I'm sorry for your loss and all that stuff. But yeah, I was able to spend time with him, but not like the people that were Bobcat or many people that were Eric Idle, people that were dear brothers of his, you know? Yeah. And I reached out to his son, Zach, who did such a beautiful thing on Robin's birthday on Twitter. And he reached back to me and just said that my dad always loved you as a friend. And that meant a lot to me because I went, really? You know, in my mind. And then he said, and he also always told me how incredibly funny you were.
I just
started bawling, you know, bawling in the old school sense, you know, from the 30s and 40s. I didn't do the 80s and 90s version of bawling.
I hope not. That would have been very inappropriate.
I started eight bawling. Oh, we've lost those kids. I was doing so good.
Oh, man. No, I remember this is like, since we're like telling old showbiz stories, I remember when I was on that show, the Family Man, the sitcom that I did before Full House, was the guy who played my grandpa was Al Molinaro from Happy Days.
Right.
And he was the one, he said he was in an improv class or like, an acting class. And I think it was on Happy Days because wasn't Mork and Mindy a spinoff of Happy Days, I think?
Yeah, put him in the 50s in Happy Days with Fonzie and Richie.
Yeah. But they needed a guy, like a weird alien guy. He's like,
That's not what they didn't need an alien guy. What happened was
the guy they hired. There's some version of this where I think Al Molinaro was the one who connected him to Gary Marshall and Tom Miller.
Maybe he thinks that, but possible. Maybe he's right. But I would say that Robin was exploding. And you couldn't take your eyes off him. And at the Comedy Store, he had already, when I met him, he had been on this Laugh-In 2. And then that didn't last. And then they were always looking for something for him. And then Gary Marshall and everybody, I mean, Miller Boyette Show, but everybody affiliated with that show just wanted to put, they wanted, when a giant star comes up,
you
just want them. So they took the premise that isn't even anywhere near what that series was about. It had nothing to do with the series because he was a, they knew that he was going to be one of the biggest stars that the world will ever see. And it just, it was a meteor. And so they had Mork from Ork land in wherever the hell.
I never saw this. We're talking about stuff I never saw.
Oh, very easy to get on. That you can get on the YouTube. That is a very simple.
When I was a kid, I liked Mork and Mindy. My mom said, I remember having the egg toy. And like Mork was in it, and the egg, it was like an egg would come out with
come out of the egg. Yeah,
I remember the toy. I don't remember watching the show so much, but yeah, I mean, that was one of those things. I feel like, you know, in my childhood, especially, but you know, as I mean, and I stayed in the entertainment business, so I feel like it still happens all the time, where I've had these weird experiences where I've gotten to like hang out or work with some of the most interesting, coolest people. And it's crazy. My wife tells me sometimes, I tell you, like, I sound like 1,000 years old.
Started happening when you were a kid.
Yeah, it's true. Now my main job now is I'm a TV writer. Like I primarily work, you know, writing TV shows. And a lot of times it'll happen in a room, like during lunch or one of our many like digressions, I'll tell some story. And I was on some show, they were like, Weinger, you just like that guy that's like, I remember when this was all orange groves. It's true.
You're Howard Hughes.
It's true. But I'm like, I remember Neil Patrick Harris doing magic tricks at my 15th birthday party. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I had a really fun and eventful childhood, and I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah, it wasn't a Hollywood brat kind of thing. You didn't have a mother that said, you better get this right. You didn't have a stage parent.
No. My parents were like, they were very, you know, they were very supportive once they saw how passionate I was about it, but they certainly didn't get me into it. I mean, it was a huge inconvenience. We lived in Florida, you know, to like have to fly to New York sometimes for auditions or fly to LA, you know, or like disrupt our life, you know, but they were cool and supportive of it, you know, which is pretty interesting because like, you know, now I'm a dad and I have a kid who's going to be 12. And like, I feel like if he wanted to be a kid actor, I don't know if I would let him, you know, I mean, I guess if he was passionate about it and it was sincere and it wasn't about like getting likes on YouTube or whatever, you know, like a lot of the kids just want to be famous for being famous. But if he had like a real sincere passion, I guess I would feel compelled to support it.
Yeah. If there's a love there and he has to do it, but you've always had a lot of love in yourself, not in yourself, your self-loathing as appropriate.
Thank you.
With a Jewish comedy-minded actor writer,
sure.
I think what I know I'm certain about is whatever your next project or the project after will be, it'll be incredibly consequential as a writer. Because
that's very sweet of you to say.
Well, it's the truth. It's just I always have known that about you. And
I have to tell you, I really love the. There was something about. When I got out of college and I came back to LA, it was just sort of like, I was like a robot. I was like, I guess I go back to LA and go back to acting and doing the thing. But it wasn't like a choice that I made. I just came out here and I wasn't enjoying it at all, going on auditions. And
I was terrific.
I hated it. And I was like, well, this is so weird. Like what changed? I went to college and I come out to LA and I'm doing the same stuff I did before. And I hate it. I'm not enjoying it at all. Like what happened? And you know, I didn't know the answer. And then I was very fortunate I started pursuing this writing thing and I was very lucky to start working. And then once you start, you know, success tends to sort of beget more success and, you know, and then you just find that you're always doing stuff. And, but then I never like had a minute to like stop and take a breath and like think about it until Fuller House came along. And then I'm like back acting again, which was totally unplanned and unintentional. And I wasn't sure. I kind of had one foot out the door in the beginning. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it, you know.
Well, it was effortless for you. You had no problem doing it. It wasn't a muscle that you learned, that you had to unlearn.
Well, you know, I was so surprised to find how much I enjoyed it. You know, that from that very first table read at Building 140 at Warner Brothers, where we all got together and it was so surreal. And I'm sitting there and I loved it so much. And I don't know why. And then finally, like I figured out, I don't even remember what season it was. I was like, the reason why I love it so much is because it's like my after school activity again. It's not like the main event, you know,
when it was same with me. That's how I felt about it.
Yeah. I mean, right. When it felt like, when you're not putting all this, when it's just for fun, then it actually is fun. I think maybe after college, I came out here and all of a sudden auditions felt like, well, this is my job. I used to see when I was a kid and I would be with my mom at an audition and I would see like people without their moms at an audition. And I was like, if you're at an audition and your mom's not taking you, you shouldn't be at an audition.
I had this attitude about smoking a cigarette afterward.
Yeah, no, but I just had this feeling like this is an after school thing. This is not a thing. This is, which is of course a ridiculous thing. Like I have a tremendous respect for the profession, but just from my for me personally, it just felt like the pressure of it was not, and it sucked all the pleasure out of it, you know? And so when
a lot of people I've talked to are like, that have worked with some of the greatest directors in film and they were cut out of the film. I remember talking to Kevin Costner once and I said, you were cut out of the, because we did a Groundlings workshop together. And I said, you were cut out of The Big Chill. I love that movie. And he went, yeah. And I said, didn't it upset you? And he said, no, because I knew that I was with the right people.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's intelligence. That's because he knew that he was going to be successful. He always was a driven person. So
I remember meeting him. This is Kevin Costner we're talking about, right? I remember meeting him with you one night at the Holly, at the what's the place we used to hang out? The blue, what the heck was it
House
called?
House of Blues.
House of Blues, at the House of Blues. We used to hang out in like the secret rooms in the back that nobody knew about.
Yeah.
It was like you would knock on the door and then there was a door behind the door. It was like the coolest thing in the world. But I remember one night I was there with you and among other people, Kevin Costner. And I remember being like having an out of body experience being like, this is so cool. My life is cool. Like, this is just crazy.
You're so funny. That's why I love you so much. He's like, this is so cool. it's great because there's an innocence to it.
Outside looking in.
Right. But that's so much healthier than today. Somebody would go, let me get a picture with the two of you, and I post it on my Instagram. I'm even guilty of that sometimes. But I only do that when I'm with someone that goes, let's put this on Instagram. Put this on the thing, Bob. But I'm not the guy that, when I've done that, I feel like a terrible person, feed the media garbage beast.
But I guess it's part of it now. I'm terrible at it. I go on, I delete Instagram from my phone because I find it like distracting. But I don't cancel my account because it feels like ungrateful or whatever. There's a lot of people following me now because of the show. And then I'll download it just to see what's going on and give a bunch of likes and then delete it again. But
I think you'd want to keep it alive as a PR tool would be your way.
Absolutely.
Not to use it as, oh, here's my family this weekend, because a lot of people do that. And I feel that that's invasive. I feel that I'm not doing a reality show of my life. So I'm not showing you, but my wife does a lot of stuff on there because she's got a company, so she does that. But and so I end up being coaxed. Let's do a TikTok, Bob.
Yeah, well, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. I think it's cool. I just, for me, I guess I feel like I don't think my life is like visually interesting enough to like post picture.
But when you're doing a new show and you're going to want to promote it, that's a great thing to have.
Absolutely, for sure. And it's true. And I feel like, it's really cool of people to follow, to take an interest and follow me. And I probably should be more gracious about like posting stuff once in a while, but I feel like
you do what you want to do. I mean, it's like,
but I do notice I go on there and if it's like 5 months since I've posted a picture, there'll be like 50,000 less followers. I'm like, people just check out. They're just
It's funny. You go to Twitter with some incredibly famous people and it's throughout the blue check mark. So it's their account. Mm-hmm. And you look at it and the last post was 6 years ago and it says, somebody hacked my account. I'm not going to be doing this anymore. That's their last tweet. That's like, good for you. I just can't believe that this whole podcast started and you put down the bookshelves behind you. See, the first thing, it's like a bad poker player. It's just saying, I got nothing.
I'm self-conscious just because it's not like,
Scott, look what I got behind me. I got crap behind me.
No, man, it looks cool. I like that nice wood desk thing and the shelf and all your cool tchotchkes and the old black and white photos of like dead people.
That's Rodney Dangerfield and Red Fox right there.
No way.
Yeah, way. And it's a Paul Mobley
shot. You knew both of those guys. You and Rodney, I know, had a great relationship.
Yeah, it was interesting. And that's my kids up there, those little pictures.
Oh, that's cool.
Things that matter, you know?
I always love going to your house because you have such cool art and such interesting stuff and just, and like showbiz, like memorabilia, and like, and you have that humidor that Rodney gave you. And just like, that's just one example of all these cool, you know.
I got to put more stuff out. I have a lot of it, and I'm realizing, wow, I should put that out there. You know, I should frame that. Because I see other people framing, oh, that's a Grammy nomination. You should have that. Like, yeah, but I didn't win. I go, no.
I'm not great about that. My wife, you know, like, she makes fun of me for all the like plastic bins full of old stuff I have. But I don't have like I don't know. I should have one Teen Beat cover framed that I was on. Like,
oh, I've got a closet.
You
full
have a few of those.
Oh, okay. I got all the Entertainment Weekly, the TV Guide, all that crap.
You know what
am I going to do? Look at that? I don't want to look at that.
No, that's it's. What, you know what I have? I have an Aladdin poster on the wall there. See, an Aladdin poster.
Where?
Right there. In the
oh, that it would be Aladdin. That's a weird looking thing. It looks like a spaceship in the air.
You know, that's the like sort of artsy one. It's like a beautiful lamp, and it's very like there was like the. It was just like it's like the classic Aladdin poster, but. And I have the boat I stole, which I feel guilty about.
Don't. And so the biggest song from Aladdin for me, for my mind, is Robin. Yeah, never have a friend like me.
Oh, yeah, that was great. That's a great
song. Is that the name of it?
That you ain't never had a friend like me. Yeah. And then, of course, there was the big Aladdin song, the big duet was the one on the what's it called? The carpet.
The name of the carpet?
A Whole New World.
Oh, that is the song. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was beautiful. Sure wish I got to sing it, but...
Yeah, now who sang it? Did you become friendly with that guy?
Yeah, well, you know, the amazing thing is, and this is pure coincidence, is his name is Brad Kane, and he is also a very busy television writer, and which is really weird. In fact, a buddy of mine, he was at a meeting once with a development executive friend of mine, and he was like, mentioned that he was the voice of Aladdin. And my friend goes, no, you're not. He was like, Scott Weiger's my friend. He's the voice. And he's like, no. And he had to explain. But, you know, he has like just a stunning, he was a film student at the time when they, you know, he's a little, I guess a few years older than me. I was 15 or whatever. He was like already, I think at NYU at film school. And he was in a band and stuff, but he like auditioned and got this, you know, he has this magnificent voice. And, you know, to this day, people come up to me, you know, because they know that I'm the voice of Aladdin, and they'll say, you have just a beautiful voice.
And you go, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. What, am I going to break their heart? I'm going to tell them the bad news?
Hey, sing for us, Scott.
Yeah. There was one time I had an audition for something, and I got there, and they asked me to sing, and I was like, oh, these poor bastards, they don't know. They think they got the other guy here. But
new world.
That was such a lucky break that I got to keep that job, that they didn't just cast somebody who could also sing.
Now, wasn't there an Aladdin TV show as well? Cartoon show?
There was so much Aladdin stuff. There were two sequels that were like these home video sequels, Return of Jafar and then The Prince of Thieves. And Robin wasn't in Return of Jafar, but he was in The Prince of Thieves. He came back for the other one. And then and then we did like 100 episodes of this like animated series, like an after school, whatever.
And you did that.
I did all that. It was great. I mean, that stuff is really fun because with the original movie, every line is such a big deal. I must have said every word in that movie, every line in that movie thousands of times, you know, just to get it perfect. And then, but with the other stuff, it's a little bit more fast and loose, you know, like we would record the show like an old timey radio show. All the actors would be sort of standing in a semicircle with the microphones.
That's the best.
So much. That was the best. So I continue to do, I mean, it's really funny because obviously I feel like my voice doesn't sound quite the same as when I was 17 years old, but I could still sort of get there. And so they'll call me and ask me to come in, you know, not much since the pandemic, but you know, now I've recorded every possible thing that a human being can say in English for them. So they can just pull it. My agent will call and they'll be like, they're doing this, you know, commercial or parade or product or digital thing. And I'm like, great, where do I have to go? And they're like, he's like, no, they're just gonna pull it, you know, and like they just pay you. They have to pull it from a thing and then pay you as if you recorded it. So it's a great situation. But they hunt me down wherever I am, all over the world. You know, when I was in Paris, they found me. They were like, they need you, it's urgent. I was like, well, I'm in Paris. They were like, they have recording studios in Paris, and the car showed up and took me to this recording studio and I record, you know what I mean? Right. And that's happened all over the world. It's pretty cool. That was a great gig. You know, it's really,
you've been blessed with a lot of stuff, and now you're blessed with an amazing wife who's really, really smart, which is great because that challenges you because you're incredibly smart. And you got this beautiful son and I think a spectacular bookcase. And anytime I do the podcast, it becomes like a Q&A sometimes, and I'm not really an interviewer, which is obvious. Some guy wrote on Twitter that I'm like, that I'm the worst. And I'm like, I was going to engage and talk to him because I was going to say no, but I want it to be a conversation as though I'm really in a room with that person.
Like we're hanging out.
That's what the idea is.
My favorite thing about this conversation is I feel like I could say anything now because nobody's still listening. My mom has.
We're coming up to the time where nobody's still listening.
You know, the fun thing about this podcast, I hope we should do it regularly. We should have a podcast where it's just this and we don't even have to put it on the internet. It's just because
let's just leave this on. We don't even have to sign off.
Of like when we would catch up after a long time and go to the Broadway deli and sit there and eat lox, eggs and onions and just like talk for a couple hours.
Right.
And there were no phones to look at or distractions or selfies or bullshit.
No, that's right.
That's what this feels like, you know, the fact that we're recording a podcast is forcing us to actually talk to each other.
Actually, BJ Novak said that in a really smart tweet the other day. It's funny you catch up with your friends without catching up with them, but just what they say
on social media.
And he said something about, you know, it's really great to catch up with if you're catching up with a friend, I'm doing it badly. He can write this so much better, but you know, the way friendship is today, you really, it's great to catch up with an old friend because you're doing their podcast.
It's
something
true.
Like that. That's my phrasing, not his. His is better because he's pretty.
But it's true. It's wise words because it's like, you know, it's so difficult. So the distractions now are so difficult. And, you know, and it's funny because I have friends without kids and stuff. And they're like, well, what I do is I do a digital cleanse where I turn my phone off and I put it in a drawer for 6 days. I'm like, you can't do that if you're a dad. You can't turn your phone off.
You can't do that anyway.
That's true too.
That's not where we are. But you can if you want to, you know, escape and go to nature and stuff.
Yeah, it's very challenging. I mean, sometimes I'll be like, I can't take it anymore. And I'll be like, I think I'm going to get one of those flip phones. But I couldn't. My car won't start without my phone.
Right.
phone is my car key. So, you can't go backwards. You gotta have you can't get a flip phone. It's too late. The genie's out of the bottle.
I have all my old phones. I'm gonna make a display out of all of them. I have them from the very beginning because you know
that's cool. I remember you always had the cool one. You always had the one that hadn't come out yet. You always had the one that was like, you can get it if you want to spend $1,000.
That's true now. That's cheap right now with all the stuff I need.
Yeah, that's true. You were always the guy. You always introduced me to technology stuff. You got my first MacBook. I got because of you. You told me where to go and what to get and how to get on the internet.
Not very hard.
You told me what America Online was and how to sign in.
Can you imagine? And it was all
that noise. Like, you know, if you want to be a cheapo, you get the 2.4 thing. But if you want to really just spend that full house money, you get the 14.4. Mbps, whatever, where it would like a little bit faster.
56.
Yeah.
That was when you really had a good signal.
But you taught me all that stuff.
I was your, I don't know what I was, your MacGyver.
What's the show with the guy with the Farrah Fawcett and all those guys?
Charlie's Angels.
Yeah. And then, Charlie. Yeah.
The guy on the speakerphone.
Yeah, you were that.
That's
guy.
Me.
Go to the store, get the MacBook, get the Who Quadrophenia.
So I'm a disembodied voice. So I can work and I could just be a head on a stick.
Yeah. You're just gonna keep going. So
well, Scott, I just love you. I just totally
It's mutual. I mean, it's funny, we go a long time sometimes just because of life without like hanging out. but it's you know, it never goes away, you know, the friendship.
No, it takes 1 second.
Yeah, exactly.
And we want to see each other in person, and we'll do that.
For sure.
This is a commitment recorded. This is a recorded commitment.
You have to go to Uso and Frank's and have a martini with your old pal Scott.
And it has to be, but we have to do the whole thing as Danny and Steve.
Yep. Gosh, Mr. T.
I wanna marry DJ.
You got the crazy DJ.
Well, the thing you did wrong that I will never forgive you for is Steve.
Oh God, what?
Well, it was in the cement truck when you were making out with DJ and the lever got hit. And the cement truck emptied into the kitchen for one of my favorite scenes that we ever did.
That was really fun. But, you know, the thing is, though, I mean, yes, it was technically my leg that pressed the lever and ruined your kitchen.
It was your leg, right?
Huh?
It was your leg, right?
It was. I mean, it was implied. But you can imagine anything. But basically, we were in that cement truck because you were breathing down our necks and we didn't get any privacy. We couldn't get, and so DJ and Steve wound up in a cement truck out of desperation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I didn't want you guys hooking up.
Danny
Tanner.
Mr. Tanner, I'm really sorry. That was so funny. That was really fun with the cement and everything. We had a good time. That was a really fun, such a fun gig. And it was fun to get a little taste of it for 5 years just now.
It was. And I think people really loved it. And that's a nice thing. And that's who I think was listening to today. And hardcore Full House fans.
The people who are still listening right now. Thank you.
The people that are hardcore Full House fans pulled out when you mentioned Harvard.
But thank God you brought it up, man.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think you did. You did. And then I just jumped on it because I forgot to talk about it.
But, you know, honestly, we really had a great time. And it was great to be back together for all that time. And it was just, I don't think it's ever going to go away.
Well, we always will love each other. Everybody involved with that show. There's not one person that there isn't mutual love and respect for.
Yeah. It's family. It truly is. I mean, at this point, after this many decades, it really is a family. And I, by the way, I don't know if other shows that ran for as long as we did, I don't know if casts stay this close. You know,
well,
what
I'll tell you, I'm kind of a conduit for a lot of the people, you know, that's
sure.
Me. I'm like the maitre d'. And this is a quote. Candace came out with a clothing line on QVC and is just selling it out. It's
for
just,
sure.
It's amazing.
Her it's business, all I wear.
It's a little too flowery for me. I like straight navy blue or black. That's what I wear. You know what? I wear one thing.
Sure.
But I have 50 black shirts. But
you have a uniform like Steve Jobs.
But Candace was doing so great. So Ashley Olsen reached out on a text and said, can I have Candace's info? Because I wanted to compliment her. Mm. And I said, absolutely. So they hadn't been in touch. And Candace put this in a release and was honest as Candace is honest and said in a text that Ashley texted her and told her how proud and happy she is for her, that she's kicking ass in the fashion business. And it meant a lot to Candace. It meant a whole lot. And when you think about all this drama, external drama that was brought on by people that, oh, we got to have Michelle back. It's like, well, what if an actor doesn't want to do something?
Yeah,
force them to do that. You know,
you can't. Doing it.
You just have to love. I love them and respect them. If you didn't want to be Steve, we'd just get the guy that sang the voice of Aladdin.
Yeah, just get that guy.
Trained actor.
You know, I did not. You know, when they called me and they said we're doing a spinoff of Full House, and then we can end it here because I know you got to go, and I know there's nobody else listening.
Well, I actually think, yeah, I got somebody coming here in a minute.
Oh, cool, cool. But like,
it's not really cool. It's just, I'm not going to make a bad joke. It'll be,
I know, me too. I'm like, no,
let's not ruin something beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. But when they, you know, it was supposed to be one episode, you know, I was supposed to do that first episode where Steve shows up in the pilot and it's like, hey, there's our old boyfriend, Steve. And that was sort of supposed to be the end of it. And then Jeff would call me every couple of weeks and be like, can you do another one?
Well, that's also because Netflix loved you, you know? That they get Warner Brothers and Netflix notes, and that's how... Those first couple years of Fuller were really inspired because it was exciting to have it all
and
back.
It was such a surprise to have the reaction that the audience, you know, it was so huge. It was like an immense, enormous success, which was unexpected. I mean, maybe other people expected it. I didn't expect, I didn't know what to expect. It was so weird.
Yeah, it was a huge shot in the arm in the very beginning. And then it did what a lot of these shows do. You
sort of cleaned out.
Yeah.
Yeah, settled down.
You know what? For Netflix, it was really a 6-season run, but they split that fifth year into two parts.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Because they had a part A and a part B. So it was like two different seasons.
And John Dave and I would do like 3 a season. That was kind of the deal. I think I did 4 one time. I don't remember.
Yeah, you guys, it felt like you were, and you guys, and Dave came and directed a couple episodes.
Dave directed 4 of them, and Candace directed a bunch, and Jody directed. And that's one of the beautiful things about it. That is a very positive thing. That isn't just saying, hey, we'll come back and you'll do this. They made it a family atmosphere. And that's why I think everyone from the cast is sad that Fuller didn't continue.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was heaven because I got to really have my cake and eat it too, in the sense that I was doing this acting.
You always ate cake at the craft service.
I ate so much cake because I was Steve. But like what I would do is in the summer, I would develop a pilot. So I would like develop a show all summer and then take a pitch out around Labor Day and thank God sell it. I mean, I was very lucky. I had a pilot every year that we did the show, basically. And so I would be up in my dressing room. Like, my only diva request was I needed a desk in my dressing room. So they gave me a desk. And so I would be up working on my pilot and then go down and do the thing. And that's how it was every season. It was just like a dream.
Didn't they have your dressing room sometimes?
Yes, I think. Well, yeah, you know what? Before I was in every episode, because I wasn't in every episode in the beginning.
Yeah.
So I would be like gone for a few weeks.
I just want you to know, and I'm going to tell you this honestly, I never dropped a deuce in there.
That is so kind.
I love you.
That you know, we had the show, we had that stage in the 90s, and then it was the Friend stage, which is what it's called now. And then it's our stage again. And I always wonder which friend had my dressing room.
Mine was Schwimmer.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
They enlarged them. They made them bigger for the
Friends.
Friends, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because I moved into Candace's old dressing room, and Candace had your old dressing room.
Yeah, she was in my old dressing room. It's so interesting.
It was great. It was so much fun to be back there. I mean, just I love the smell of Warner Brothers sound stages. You know what I mean? It's just like you just
I love that engineer butt crack smell.
Yeah. Mm.
Scott, I will see you soon.
All right. And right now, Bob, by the way, I'm writing a show for Disney Plus that hasn't been announced or anything. It's a pilot. You know, we haven't gotten to shoot it or anything. But I want to come back on your podcast and talk about it if I'm fortunate enough to make
done.
It.
It's done. What part do I play?
The lead. You play the lead. You play
EP? A dying teenager. I'm an EP also. I play a dying what?
A dying teenager.
Oh, great. Great. Yeah. That sounds fun.
You don't look like a teenager, but if I said, but he's not well.
Well, also, from the waist down, I'm very youthful.
Very.
Scott Weinger. That is a friend for life. Friend for life, you know? I don't take friendships lightly. Sometimes you wish you could stay friends with people and you're not as close with. I'm sure many of you go through that, where you go, oh, we used to be friends and we're not anymore, and I miss that person. Well, I don't know. Now's as good time as any to reach out and see if there's anything still there. You could do that. I do it because I have a podcast. But, you know, you can pretend you don't have a podcast. I'm doing it more anyway. I'm reaching out and calling people that I care about. Not a lot, but people that matter, you know, people that you love. Just give them a shout out. It can be a text. It can be an email. I don't know. Just try to put yourself in their shoes, maybe. And if you're hurting, maybe you've got some friends there that could be there for you. You never know. But Scott is a true friend and will always be, not just DJ's boyfriend on Full and Fuller House. So I love him very much. And when his new show comes out, when it gets made, I know it's going to be good. The guy's just really talented. So he is, like I say always, onward and upward. I think I coined it. Yeah, right. Lots of love, and talk to you next time.